Hey, welcome back. Pull up to the side of the PCH. Carry your board down to the Rhetoric Warriors Beach, where we surf the oceans of language and persuasion, always in search of the perfect ride. I'm doing a California intro today, Claude,
Love that.
Your Californian-ness. I'm Dr. Dan. I'll be your Laird Hamilton of rhetoric today. Big claim to live up to. Rhetorician, late night comedy writer, founder of Rhetoric Warriors, the podcast. I talk to comedians about their careers and their politics. I convert conservatives because the right worries me. And I talk to persuasion pros and rhetoricians. This podcast has more rhetoricians than any podcast in the world. So deal with that. My guest today, good buddy of mine, part jitterbug, part comedian, part tech savvy entrepreneur. He's got more hair right now than I've ever seen ever. He's smart, funny. He's got ADD plus a couple more DDs and H's and stuff in there to make sure. We're going to cover some ground because he's done a lot. Welcome, Claude Laugh Lounge Shires.
Woo-hoo! Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
What's up? Santa Monica. You're in Santa Monica today still, right?
No, I'm in Mar Vista, just a little bit. It's a little bit poorer than Santa Monica. It's a little more east, a little more poor in Santa Monica. Yeah, we're still there. I'm still cutting comedy specials. I mean, that's, you know, and directing, and that's kind of my jam. I mean, it feels weird to say that, but yeah.
So run your background a little bit. Like right now, that's sort of your main thing. Like you got a post house and a production house there in the LA area, and you do a lot of stand-up work.
Yep. So, you know, I started as a stand-up, like, you know, coming to LA like everybody else, like, dude, I'm going to make it. And then everybody that rejected me is going to get to watch me on TV, you know, and
get to keep rejecting me.
That's right. Now they get to reject me in person here in LA. So doing that, you know, was kind of the jam. But, you know, it actually worked out so much better because I always wanted to be the famous stand-up, to be honest. I mean, who doesn't, right? Like, you want all that, you know, when you're killing, you want that level of recognition. But to me, I found out that, you know, that editing comedy specials was like way more fun, you know? And for me as a comic, and lucrative. I mean, it's like the comedy store pays well, but $15 a night in the OR was never going to be like, yeah. You know? So anyway.
Tell some of the specials that you've cut that people can go check
out. So, most recently I did Felipe Esparza's stand-up comedy special on Netflix, Malas Decisiones, in Spanish. So, that was fun, trying to speak Spanish in front of Netflix. like, no, I swear I can speak this shit, you know? Like, but it was super fun. And then I did, I'm trying to think of most recently, Jimmy Schubert's, and then before that, a slew of you know, Joan Rivers, Andrew Dice Clay, Indestructible. We worked on Pete Holmes, Owen Benjamin, Al Madrigal, Kamel Nanjiani. These are all just ones that we've worked on through post, you know? And
yeah, so you've done some people. You've done some comedy.
Yeah. And I'm still learning. I mean, it's like, you know, I think the nice thing about being a comic and doing comedy specials is that, you know, the critical element for comedy is timing. Right? Like, it's like, so in post, we get to fix all that shit, you know? It's like, no, man, this joke actually was second set number two, but it's showing up in, you know, in number one because the timing is just better. So I think having that level of control and not so much chaos that comedy actually provides, you know, was just something that I needed, you know, some more of that kind of, you know, organized right brain or left brain shit, you know?
Yeah. And when I worked at Best Damn Sports, we cut a cold open every day. So we had some type of a sketch every day, and they had four producers and only one of them was funny. The other one cut sports. And so if you got assigned a guy or a girl who was the producer, who's going to help you put it all together, go in the edit bay with you, try to make decisions, they just killed it by all the decisions that they made along the way. The props weren't funny. The location wasn't funny. The casting, all that stuff. And there was one guy who was just great.
Yeah.
And he was making stuff better. So there you go. You're making people better.
No, well, that's the thing. That's what you want to be, you know? It's and I think that giving up and or submitting to the fact that it was like, look, I'm not going to be Daniel Tosh. I'm not going to be, I'm not going to be Chris D'Elia for a couple different reasons, but I'm never going to be like those, you know? I'm just not going to be at that level. And my goals kind of changed, as you know, like, you know, wife, daughter, like, you got to build things and you start becoming more responsible, which kind of hones your craft. So for me, you know, getting into post.
Go all the way back. Like I said, like you've had a pretty rangy life.
Oh, yeah. Like yeah. Started, well, how far do you want to go back?
Didn't you start in Florida? Weren't you born in Florida?
Yeah, I'm always apologizing for that fucking state, you know, like, you know, I'm from Florida. Sorry about that, by the way. So I grew up in Tampa, right? Well, you know, I want to say I was kind of raised by wolves, but I can't be that generous to my family. So
in Tampa? I thought your old man was in Gainesville.
So no, they started in Gainesville. Dude, this is kind of nuts. If you want to, like, so my mom and dad, according to my mom and dad met in the ER, right? She was an ER nurse. My dad was this, you know, big slinging, you know, doctor, nephrologist, former Marine, like doctor. It's funny. I try to put myself in his shoes now. And I see why he just slayed, you know? So he was in there and there was this guy who came in and had a heart attack. He'd been in a car accident and he had an inflammation of the pericardial sac, right? So what they have to do is they have to take a big ass needle, like a Pulp Fiction style needle. And what they do is they go in And you got to know what you're doing, right?
You got to know what you're doing. I'm going to try this.
This isn't something you want to try at home with a turkey baster, right? So my dad comes in and my mom's a nurse, so she's doing what she can, you know, but she's not a doctor, she's not ER, whatever. So my dad comes in and the guy like goes unconscious or whatever, and they like pull off his chest or whatever. And my dad just pulls out the fucking thing, stabs the dude, right? Like deflates the pericardial sac, his heart starts beating again, and he comes back alive. And it was like, that was it, you know? My dad said, leave his first wife and go to this, you know, and go to my mom. So
watch me resurrect this guy.
That's right.
Online dating profile.
Imagine what I could do for you. Yeah, exactly. So that was, you know, their relationship. And that's like some drama in my family is that, so my mom's name is Patricia. And in my dad's first marriage, so I'm the youngest of eight kids, but in my dad's first, it's crazy, right? There's five in my dad's first marriage. And then the youngest kid, his name is Patricia, right? My sister, right? Patricia, the youngest out of that first five. And that's my mom's name. So I was like, is my dad pimp enough to be like, I'm cheap, you know, I'm gonna go ahead and move on. And you know what? I'm gonna name my daughter after this chick. That's like the ultimate. So that was like my youngest sister, right, has the same name as my mom. I didn't even put that together until like a few years ago. I was like, damn. But my dad was very much legendary in that area. So then I have my twin brother and my brother John, who's 2 years older than me.
You have a twin?
Yeah, I have a twin brother. Yeah, well, Boulder, he lives in Boulder. We went to college there and he just stayed. I don't blame him. So, I don't think he ever been to Boulder. Yeah, fraternal.
Fraternal, okay.
Yeah, he's like 6'2". I was always telling people, when I grew up, it was like, if you could have split our our personalities, it's like, I was always like Kirk and he's like Spock. He was always like so logical, you know? Like, I'm like, dude, we should go meet these chicks and go to this thing. And he's like, we should do homework. And I was like, oh, come on, Buzz Killington. So then I would, you know, I'd be like, look, I got the keys to dad's car. We're going to drive to Davis Island. We're going to go to this girl's house. And then our parents are out of, you know, at the center club or some shit. So, you know, but he would always drive us back. So it was good.
That's hilarious. And so just because it's such a biography point, just explain real quick the Gatorade thing.
Oh, okay. Well, so the Gatorade thing. Well, the Gatorade thing is actually kind of a cool, funny entrepreneurial story too. But so my dad is one of the four. If you ask him, he's like, it was me. The whole thing was, sure, it was you. Do you know what I mean? It's just me. It was my idea, you know. But I think that, you know, it was the four guys, Dr. Cade, Dr. Free, Dr. DeCasada, and Dr. Shires, my dad, who came up with Gatorade while working in a nephrology lab. And for those of you who don't know, nephrology is kidneys. The nephrol is the functional unit of the kidney. And so my dad's a nephrologist. You know, it was funny because he had five kids before he went to med school, or like during like college and med school. I mean, can you imagine? And then being like, that's why he went to med school. He's like, fuck this. I don't have time for any of this shit. I'm just going to go focus on work. Yeah. So he's in the Marine Corps. It's kind of a crazy story. But anyway, long story short is to catch up to the Gatorade thing. They basically were trying to figure out a way to short circuit the gut. Because like when you typically absorb water, it's done in the lower intestines. And they figured, like, if you put, you know, as nephrologists who are just in there like, nah, positive in this way, negative, you know, salt, whatever, this way. So somebody came up with the idea that, well, why don't we try to short circuit the gut? Because your gut has these natural fours, ionophores that carry, you know, positive and negative ions on there. So water is amphiphilic or whatever. So you could pour water in that way, pull it in rather. And so they figured out, like, let's try it in a drink. Somebody was like, let's try it in beer. So they ended up actually trying it in beer, which didn't work. Can you imagine, like, a bunch of super hydrated alcoholics? That's just what we need. So then they tried it in milk, which was horrible. But then they used the milk cartons to do the actual beverage. And then it was kind of a good decoy because I think a few times the other teams were like, you're drinking milk, goddammit. Let's go get some milk. So they, so anyway, that's kind of the biographical, you know, element is that he was, you know, eight, you know, father of eight, actually 10, but father of, you know, whatever, a huge amount of kids. And, you know, being in the Marine Corps, then in medical school, you know, and then starting an organ and tissue harvesting business. My old job.
Man, that's, yeah, like I said, so you've got some biography points. Like if we go back and just plot you out about, oh, here's Claude Shire's life. People are like, yeah. I mean, you'll kind of whip your head around a lot. You might get a little whiplash.
Yeah, I think so. Well,
so you went into the Marines, which I still can't believe the fact that you were a Marine.
You know, it's funny. Even the Marine Corps had that problem. They're like, "What are you doing here?" So I was. It was kind of an interesting, you know, story about. I guess I was 17, and my parents were like, "Listen, we're gonna take you to this facility," because I was partying with my friends and I was probably out of control. I mean, you know, 17 in Florida, that's what you're supposed to be, out of control, you know? That's how you become a parent in Florida at 17. So my mom dropped me off. They were like, hey, so we're going to take you to a place to get evaluation. Like, my brother got sent to this rehab in Minnesota, Hazelden, right? And I got sent to this rehab in, my twin brother and I, they separated us by putting us in different rehabs. So they sent him to Minnesota, which was full. So he ended up going to Atlanta, and they sent me to this. Mine wasn't full because mine was a year long outdoor program, like, you know, like straight, like one of those kind of places. And so so I went from that, you know, I literally turned 18 in treatment. Yeah, I spent my entire, you know, and then as soon as I got out of there, I basically went in the Marine Corps. You know, I signed up to go in the Marine Corps, and it took me whatever 9 months to get ready to go into the Marine Corps. It was like, and Danny Bevins does this great joke, which I feel like applies here. You know, he's like, yeah. He goes, I got tired of my, I went in the military because I got tired of my parents trying to run my life, you know? And the recruiter was like, sign here, dipshit, we'll run it for you. And love Danny. So that.
Is that literally your thought process? I mean, you went into the military just to sort of get away?
Like, well, I think for me, I was just kind of like, you know, fuck, you know, that, like, I was so triggered at my dad. You know, first off, like, my parents dropped me off at this place. They're like, you're going to be here for 2 weeks. I was here for a fucking year.
Wow.
You
know what I mean? Yeah.
So I had some resentments on that. And then I was like, you know, take your, you know, keep your fucking, your white middle class, stick it up your, you know, take your life and stick it up your ass. My dad's like, you're not going to the Marine Corps. It's like reverse psychology, you know? So I went in there and I had to lie my ass off to get in because I just went to fucking drug rehab for a year. Right. So then I go into the Marine Corps. And I remember I tried to get out of the Marine Corps. I was in Paris Island. I watched Full Metal Jacket too many times. I thought I fucking wanted to be, you know, Private Joker or whatever. So I get in there and I'm like, the whole time I'd lied my ass off about fucking going to rehab and, you know, whatever. So when I got there, I remember that was like my trump card, right? I was like, dude, if shit just hits a fan, I'll be like, dude, I was fucking, you know, when I was in rehab, I fucking lied. Joke's on you guys, you know? Well, I remember going to my senior DI, Sergeant Vaught, you know, drill instructor, Sergeant Vaught. You can't fuck up his title, right? And so I went in there and I was like, sir, request permission to speak freely. And he's like, what is it, scumbag? And I was like, sir, I just wanted to come clean with you that, you know, I'm a drug addict. You know what I mean? And I was like, and I was in rehab and I lied about it during the interview. And he's just sitting there the whole time just listening to me. Doesn't even faze him one fucking bit, you know? And so I get to the end of my diatribe, like my confession, and he's just like, I don't give a shit about your drug problem, you know, scumbag. He's like, now get back in line with all those other lying drug addict scumbags, you know? So I just remember, you know, I was like, and then I was like, oh, fuck, I fucked up, bro. Like, now they're going to fucking, and then the whole rest of the cycle, It was like, too bad there's not some goddamn ganja up there. Shire's get his ass up that hill if there was some ecstasy, you know, or whatever.
So then,
and I was like, fuck, the whole time they're going to run me through this entire cycle and just ditch me at the end. You know, they're going to be like, you're disqualified, scumbag. Thanks for giving us 13 weeks of your life, you know, or whatever. So, but they didn't do that, you know. They were like, you know, you made it and whatever. We don't give a fuck about your drug history, you know. It's like, you know, you're a Marine now. Get out there and fucking kick ass or whatever, right? So I was like energized by that. I was like, the first time I was actually, it actually worked on me, you know. And then from there, I was smart enough to be in the Reserve Marine Corps. And of course, all of the Gulf War happened while I was in boot camp. Like every night they were like wheeling in televisions and shit and like, see these goddamn Scud missiles are coming up, you know? This is why we, you know, you guys are going to the gas chamber so you can prepare. I was like, fuck, dude, I just signed up to do weekends. I don't want to fucking kill anyone, you know? So getting through that was really just kind of, you know, I think if you, I'm sorry, I'm not trying to shout right now. I realize I'm talking super loud.
No, you're good. Your volume's a little low, so it's working.
Okay, perfect. So I realized, like, if you look at my brothers and my life, just my whole family, like, dude, like, the Marine Corps empowered me to just be like, you know, you can just go out there and fucking, if you want to move to Hong Kong, go fucking do it. You know, like, there was no, you know, and I think that at such a young, impressionable age, that was really the only parenting I had. You know, it was like, with my dad, it was just like, doctor 24 hours a day, just when he's not doing that, he's banging, like, his wife's best friend, like, whatever. He's just crushing it, you know, and so when I got in the Marine Corps, it was like, no, you're fucking accountable. Like, you know, where's your fucking boot brush, bitch? You're like, oh, my fucking boot brush. Like, shit, somebody stole it. Well, go fucking take it back. You know, like all that shit. I was just like, dude, it was like a surgical process that somewhat removed a spoon from my ass, you know, I think. And since then, it's unfortunately like empowered me to go on and do shit like start a company or fucking learn how to edit video. You know, and I think that was kind of the big point for me was, you know, that it really enabled me to be powerful in the areas that I wanted to be, you know, but it required an ADHD motherfucker to be like, that's what I was going to say earlier when you were like ADD. I was like, my doctor told me I have UHD ADHD. It's four times the HD as the regular bear, I think. So I need four times the meds.
You talk about that too, like that, you know, that all that energy you have, that neurological energy, that body energy and everything else, you take that into the most hardened discipline system in the world. And maybe there is a middle ground, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, what was great about it is like, and it sounds crazy when I say this, but the Marine Corps was very relaxing for me because like there was no decision making to be made. It was like, listen, this is where you eat. This is what you get. Here's your clothes. Here's the time you need to be up in the morning. And we're going to beat the shit out of you if you don't do any of it. So it was literally like no decisions to be made. I remember being in Virginia Beach. I was stationed at this naval amphibious base there for training. And I remember being like, God, this is amazing. Like, you know, and on weekends, it's like, fuck off. Your time is your time. Do whatever you want to do. So it was like, I'm working and sleeping with everybody that I work with. You know, and then when the weekends come, it's like complete freedom. Like, no, like, you know, it's not like, oh, let me fucking check on this fucking back end CMS bullshit. Like, you know,
right. It's kind of one of the models in Hollywood for getting production done, that on most screenwriting and most writing staffs, you have the super creative people who are all over the place. And then you have the mechanics, you know, yeah, the technicians who will make sure the story's in place, make sure everything's there. And then the other people are just throwing shit into it. You know, 90% of it you just get rid of. But then the 10% is just uranium, man. They just come up with the greatest stuff.
Yeah,
that,
yeah.
That double, you know, having that double consciousness of superstructure and super creatives, pretty powerful combo.
That's a great point, man. I mean, and I think you're right. It's like the creatives and technicals rarely mix until it's like down pipeline of a project, you know? That's why we don't let actors in the editing bay. You know what I mean? It's like, you'll never get through shit. Like, dude, you look fucking fine, bro. Get the fuck out of here.
Oh, it's nuts. Yeah. I, that's one of the things I liked about a really good producer is, again, they know who to keep out of the room.
Yeah. Yeah.
Get shit done. Like, they're like, hey, this goes on the air in 6 minutes. I don't want to hear anything from anybody over here.
Yeah.
Cut, go.
Exactly. And then like, I've learned these lessons, like never have a director of photography and a director into a color grading session. because they'll fucking fight over everything. Because the DP likes how he shot it and like was committed to when he shot it on the day, and the director's there, but this doesn't look like the fucking movie that I want it to look like. So you get one or the other, and then you just, because if they try to book separate sessions with you, you just end up fucking taking forever. So that's like, so that's part of the reason I like kind of trans, I kind of like am at the threshold of both of those. I mean, just in the sense of, you know, creative and post, because you can't really produce things, I don't think, unless you have a grip on everything. Like, I, you don't have to do everything, but you got to know everything
right
to a certain level of confidence to where you can be like, dude, where the fuck is the best boy grip? Or, you know what I mean? Or like, we need electric and gaffers in here because this looks like shit. We have no lighting, you know? Like, until you've done those jobs, even if you're just around them or running cable or whatever, you're never going to have, you're never going to have the confidence that you need to have in order to do that job. To walk into set and be like, I can call commands to people and I don't feel like a dick because I know what I'm asking for because I needed to get the job done. And when you're first in town, you don't have that. You're like, hey, fucking what the fuck, crazy. You know?
I remember the first time I produced a segment on Best Damn Sports, and it was a Weekend Update ripoff where we just did sports instead of the SNL Weekend Update. And so I got a desk, Oshak. We had Oshak at the desk.
Yeah.
And I was producing it, so I got to put together the script and run the whole thing. And we came in to block it all out the way we were going to shoot it. And they started, the first thing they hit me with is like, okay, do you want to OTS left or right? I'm like, I don't know what that means.
Yeah. Right.
And they're like, they get, the director got so pissed at me. He's like, make a decision. Like, left, you know? And so that first time through, I was making all these decisions because I was the producer, but they had no logic or theory behind them, you know? And then I realized, oh, it has to be on the right because of what we're doing here.
Yeah.
So first time through, you know how to do, how to answer all that. But unless you've got that professional experience, you're lost.
Yeah. And it's like, and that's how this town, I mean, at least previously, and I'm sure in a lot of ways it still is, just this industry really, is that you got to go in being a dipshit. Just go in being a dipshit, not knowing anything, but just be open to learning. And that's why being a PA is such a great gig, is if you don't know fucking shit about production, be a PA for $150 a day, whatever, and then just keep your fucking mouth shut and watch.
Yeah, you know? That's the only way to learn the actual Pico level crap that goes into all these things. So I just finished this book, 21 Colosseums of Persuasion. And essentially I lay out all the major theories that make persuasion good. And one of them is professionalization. That if you want to put a professionalized message up against an amateur message and tell me which one's going to win,
yeah,
I have no idea, like the Hollywood level professionalization, how good everybody is, and how yeah. many jobs there are.
Yeah,
with just one message structure.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just filmmaking in like the truest sense of the word. Like, I mean, not even not all the stuff that we do. It's all video cameras and it's cinematic and whatever. But like, I mean, dude, a fucking film is like 1,000 people working on it. You know what I mean? Like, if you look, just watch the end credits of some of these, and you're like, and they're all the best, like at their game. You know, like you're not getting like a title sequence from Game of Thrones from somebody that doesn't know what the fuck they're doing.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? It's like that level of like precision. It's like you're looking at 30 years worth of education and experience per person in that. Do you know what I mean? Just to get something like that just conceptualized. And then another, like to your point, a technical person to come in and be like, okay, the virtual camera is going to do this and whatever. So, and part of what I've kind of fallen in love with on that side is that, dude, it's forever changing, you know, like the cameras that we use now are such a high resolution that you can reframe them. Like, and so it's like two different camera, three different camera positions and one camera angle. I can do a head to toe and a waist up and a close up. One camera, you know, I mean, it's just nuts.
Insane.
So,
all right. So I'm going to move you back again, yeah. And then we're going to, I know where I want to go in this. So
sure.
Your other weird job that you've had, tissue harvester, which I think when we first met, that's what you were doing.
Yes.
Talk about that a little bit.
So part of, you know, one of these things that I kind of pride myself on is that not being squeamish, right? With shit, you know, because that's, I don't know, because I was at, when I got out of the Marine Corps, I went to college in San Diego, and I went to Cal State University, San Marcos. That's where I ultimately graduated from. Started University of Colorado, ended there. But I actually went back to biology. I was like, this is cool, you know. So I got into molecular, cellular, developmental biology, just basically like, but you know, microbiology, cellular biology, all the shit in the cell. And fell in love with that again, right? And so that's why editing is kind of like digital biology. Sure. That's kind of how I look at it. But I fell in love with biology, and so, but I also wanted to make some money. So I was doing stand up, and again, we're not making any money stand up. I'm like a 3-year paid regular. You know, I've been doing stand up like 3 or 4 years. And so, but I want, so I want to work on my stand up, but I got to make some money, right? So there's good comedy clubs in Tampa. There's good comedy clubs in Atlanta, right? So I go, okay, well, here's what I'm going to do. Like, I can't not work. And plus, you know, you can't pay for an apartment in LA, be on the road 3 weeks a month, and you come home and you're like, what the fuck am I even doing here? I can't audition for a week and then go out and not get a call back or whatever. I won't be here. So so I was like, well, listen, I can get this job as an organ and tissue harvester, right? And you basically, you know, had my biology degree, right? At this point, I was actually had my biology degree, and I had my EMT. So I had my EMT certification. So I was like, you know, they're like, that's all you need to have is like a bio degree and an appreciation for sterility. And then you can basically go work as an organ and tissue harvester where you cut out the bones and tissues of dead people, like right as, like right after they're dead. And it was like the perfect compliment for stand-up, right? I was doing stand-up, you know, at Side Splitters in Tampa. And then I'm like going into the organ and tissue retrieval at LifeLink to go, you know, take apart some, you know, dead person.
It's like, and, hey, I think I made this guy laugh earlier tonight.
Dude, we were joking about that all the time. My brothers and I just wrote this screenplay that we're like, we can't come up with a name yet. We're still debating it. But yeah, but basically doing that and then going, I was like, I don't know which audience is worse. Like, you know, the which audience is more dead? And then it just started kind of creeping into my dreams where I'd be like, I go to the comedy club, I go to the Punchline, right, in Atlanta. Then I would go to like the medical examiner's office and do a body or whatever. Then I'd go back to, you know, the Punchline for the Late Show if I could. And so I'd be like doing stand-up, and I had pager back then. That was like what they used, because they page you, you just call them and they're like, okay, we need you in 2 hours or 4 hours or whatever. So so anyway, so it was a very interesting time. And then I would have these nightmares that I'd be like, you know, like I had a nightmare that I took one of the bodies home with me. Because I was just in a rush and I was tired, so I just put him in my car and I took him back to my brother's apartment where I was staying at the time. And I was like, I'll just do this one on the coffee table, dude. Nobody gives a fuck. There's nobody here. You know, and that the dog had actually eaten the foot off of one of them. And I was like, no way, dude. So that was an interesting time, to say the least. And definitely gave me, you know, a kind of a perspective, you know, dealing with people that whose lives were interrupted, you know.
Right. Okay, so you went from, you know, partying in Florida to the Marines to comedy and tissue harvesting, and now you've moved to LA, and you're a tech guy, you're tech savvy, you're good with tech, at least in my world, you know, compared to me, you're Steve Jobs, but although I guess he wasn't a tech guy, but you started doing tech, so talk about that, like, because I want to get to where your entrepreneurial stuff, and I want to talk about Laugh Lounge.
Yeah.
Take us through that process of how you suddenly ended up, not suddenly, but you merged over into tech and then, you know, into business. So
sure. So kind of how I ended up in tech was because I hurt my neck. interestingly enough.
Somebody's eyeball out or something, right?
Well, no, it was after I'd moved into video editing in LA, and I wasn't getting spots at the store regularly, and I was like, wow, this is just really easy for me to do at home, right? So I got into that. And then I went to Magic Mountain with my two nephews. They'd come stay with me from Atlanta for like 2 weeks. And like the last week that they were there, I went on this ride, Goliath, right? Which is like the roll. So we got the speed pass, right? Which is like gets everybody angry because you just cut the line every time. So I got that, and I did like 36 roller coasters in like 2 hours or some shit. Like, and I blew my neck out. I literally herniated a disc in my neck. I remember because I was pushing it back in, like, oh, I feel so much better. Like while I was in the parking lot, I was like, this is not good. Like, and but I remember feeling it pop on that fucking ride, and so. The next day, I was like, I got to get into tech. No, so I had it pop on that ride. And then I, you know, literally they were like, you want to get neck surgery? And I was like, dude, I don't want fucking neck surgery. I was like 38 years old or 36 or whatever. And I was younger than that. I was 34 because I didn't have my kid yet. So anyway, long story short is I hurt my neck. And it was really hard for me to sit in an editing chair, Do you know what I mean? And so I met someone who was into tech, a friend of mine, and we started a crowdfunding platform. Well, he was already doing a crowdfunding platform. And I remember being like, I was like, God, I got to do something different. And I felt like I was kind of getting left behind, you know, because you see all these, you know, you see all these great inventions like, you know, Instagram or Facebook or whatever. I mean, I'm not saying all those are great, but you just see like, you know, super useful stuff, even like Asana or Trello or, you know, and you start thinking to yourself like, dude, what a better, more fertile place is there can't be than tech. Because you can build the shit in a certain language. You can tell it how to run. You can like, you know, you don't even have to be technologically like savvy to want to do that, right? You just got to be able to communicate. So it's got to look like this. It's got to feel like this. And it has to do this. And so, you know, you can do that, but it's harder to do that in real life than it is in software, you know? In software, you're like, fuck it, dude. I want to take PayPal. I want it to do Venmo. Or I want to sign these contracts and I want that to go out that way. All that is manageable in code. And it's just way easier to create, you know, I think is the key word. And so for me, with an injured neck, you know, I went down the pathway, which turned out to be a disaster, put in all my own money and crashed the startup, this crowdfunding platform. And it was kind of like
the YouTube thing, right?
Well, that's still going, actually. So I created a YouTube channel for comedy. It's now Laugh Lounge. It was Stand Up Bits, right? At first, the YouTube channel, which is still up there. But now it's just populated with our content. But the point was I jumped into that. And then we were trying to build a crowdfunding platform for YouTubers. Seems like a great idea at the time. Like they YouTubers have tons of subscribers. They're not paying any money though.
Right.
You know what I mean? And YouTubers are like 9 or 13. Like they don't have any money. They don't have credit cards. So crowdfunding platform for YouTubers. And then we got all of the major YouTube networks in. I went in and like, you know, trained people on the software. My partner managed all the development, and then we just couldn't get anybody to run campaigns on it, dude. Running campaigns, crowdfunding campaigns are a draconian amount of effort. If you've never done one, it's like, and so I was running like 15 at a time. It was just hell, dude.
Yeah.
And so, and the long and short of it is that, you know, I made a lot of bad decisions in that. My partner made a ton of bad decisions. It was like, it was just not, and I learned from it though. That's kind of the take home if I can. So, you know, it was like, you know, don't put in all your own money, you know, run it like it's somebody else's company that you work for somebody else. Anyway, long story short is that crashed and I lost all of our life savings, right? And so, but at the time it was like, I mean, I think the great advantage that people have today is the internet, dude. You can learn fucking anything. You can truly
instantly
learn anything.
Yeah, it's crazy.
You just got to be like willing. You got to just go be like, I want to learn this. It's like, nah. So having, being equipped and willing to be the guy to step into the ring. I mean, that's kind of like what the Marines created in me. It just made me like, okay, now I want to do this. And so after I had like burned this startup with all my wife and I's life savings to the ground, I went back to my core competency, which is video editing. My neck had healed up and I'd been doing live production streaming as well, because that was kind of new, 2014, right? 2015, like, you know, like multiple en masse. So I went to Amazon. They were like, hey, you're doing this technical editing for us and for the live stream. Do you want to direct these series for us in San Francisco? And I was like, fuck yeah, I do.
Yeah, sure.
And then I hung up. I was like, oh shit, I got to fucking learn how to direct. So, and I had been around directors on multicam shoots. I just never done it. So you don't get anywhere unless you jump in, right? So I was like, okay, you know, I'll do it. And then I hung up the phone and I like pissed myself. I was like, shit. I told my wife, she was like, what did you do? I was like, dude, there's no other way we're going to do this. I just have to do it. And she was like, okay, cowboy, go fucking burn down some more of our money. So I went to San Francisco and I did that. And I literally hired people that were so much better than me.
Yeah. That's the nice thing about this kind of production.
Yeah.
You surround yourself with a lot of people that can
make you look good. You know what I mean? And so, and that's part of the game, right? Be a great talent scout. Don't be a dick. Be generous. Be nice to everybody and hire the best fucking people and never let them go. That's why people work together on all this shit. You know, you got to fend off all the douchebags until you find your crew, you know, core. And then you keep going making films and everybody does that, you know? It's like, I'm the complete opposite. People are like, oh, don't work with your friends. Fuck you, I only want to work with my friends, you know? The key to that is being responsible, accountable, don't be an asshole, you know? And then everybody's fine. So By the way, like becoming CEO was like the hardest thing because I'm such a people pleaser. It's not until you have to fire like 20 people that you become like Norm in that episode of Cheers where he's like, you know, firing everybody, doesn't care anymore. He's like, fuck you, you're out of here. So, but I digress. So long story short is crowdfunding platform crashed, YouTube channel success, right? Didn't really make any money, but learned how to do it. And then parlayed that into when I was working for Amazon, and I was directing, live streaming, and I knew all the comedians I was directing, right? So it was like, well, fuck, dude, we should just start our own platform. And that's what Laugh Lounge is. So basically, and again, you know, you can draw a pathway. You know, speaking of Steve Jobs, he's got this quote that I love. He goes, you can never connect the dots looking forward. You can only connect them looking backwards, you know? So if you go, well, fuck, you're going to learn how to do YouTube video streaming here, or video editing, or whatever. So that's how what Laugh Lounge is even a little bit of the crowdfunding, because we have a partner program that allows people to make money based on the subscriptions that they drive, right? And also content that we create together or that we just take, we can put out across all platforms, and we market it, edit it, color correct it, put in all the graphics on my other day job, and then we put it out and share the revenue. So,
and it's morphed, right? I mean, before the pandemic, you were doing the live shows, like buy a ticket to a live show. That was kind of the main offer. Has it now morphed into like you're more warehousing great comedy that people can find? The main offer?
Well, I think with it opening back up, like what I'm really looking forward to is just having our network of live shows from all over the country. And then having that feed into the app and the website so that you can buy a live show, because before COVID even hit, we were doing that because I've been convinced for a long time that there's just a contingent of people that want a live comedy experience, you know, and they just can't get to one because they live in fucking Des Moines, right, or wherever, you know, or you live wherever there's no club, you know, and I don't think that just applies here. Like we're trying to apply that to the whole world. You know, like let's get some comics from Uzbekistan, you know, or let's get some comics, you know, from Bollywood. You know, there's good comedy there. There's a couple, there's two clubs in Hong Kong. There's an American club and an English club there, or in a British club, you know? So I think that like ultimately what we want to be is a place and a home for stand-up comedy that benefits the artist more than anything else. That's my goal, right? I mean, I want to make $1 billion, of course. I mean, we all want to make money. But I'm trying to figure out a way that we can make money together and build that into the model. So
it's like, I think that's one of the reasons why I've always liked it is that if you take care of the artists, the comedians, you give them a good venue, you give them a way to make money, you don't take advantage of them, you're not an asshole to work for, they're going to bring you good content. They're going to do the work. And the only thing that the audience cares about is whether somebody has done the work to bring a good show together.
Yes,
they could care less about where it is, anything else. I mean, it's a nice marketing hook, but really it's about, do they bring the power, you know? Like I watched Dry Bar Comedy, and those guys, I think, have done an interesting thing with a lot of road comics and sort of harvesting from that kind of population. But they don't pay them a ton, but they pay them some, but it has to be clean. And guys are all burning their B-level and C-level material. Not that it's not good because they're pro comics.
Yeah.
But it's still not their A game.
And well, that's where we come in, right? And I actually talked to Dry Bar because, look, I'd love to partner with them, you know? Like, so we're, you know, I'm a collaborator before. I'm a collaborator first, a competitor last, you know? So, I think that good comedy is everywhere. It really is. You know what I mean? There's good writers everywhere. There's people that are just starting out. And I think what we're hoping to do is also break some great comics, because we're only doing short sets anyway. I'm not doing like, I'm not putting up a headliner set, you know? Like we just don't have that kind of time, you know? So we're putting up shows that are like 4 comics, 5 comics, you know, 10 minute sets, stuff like that, because, you know, I mean, you and I both know tons of comedians. I'm like, dude, that fucking bit that you have about whatever kills, but you don't have 40 minutes. You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, there was a comic, you know, God rest his soul, Tom Lloyd. I don't know if you ever met Tom Lloyd.
I don't think
so. He was super funny. He seemed like he was always old, you know, like he was, just, you know, when I first met him, you know, he would come there like he looks like somebody that would sell you insurance, but he, you know, he's like 57 years old. And then he would just come to the comedy store in regular clothes, a dress. You know what I mean? And so, that, you know, that kind of stuff. And, but he passed away, you know, sadly. It was like, you know, he didn't have enough money to support it, to own his medication. So he was like taking half seas of his seizure medication and had a seizure and drowned in his hot tub.
Oh,
so gnarly, dude. And I remember.
That's a very California way to go, though.
Yeah, totally. And the point I was going to make is that, like, about comics that never had 40 minutes, he never had 40 minutes, but he always wanted to headline. So Dangerous Dick, the DJ from San Diego, who's also a comic in our little group there at the La Jolla store, he put together 40 minutes of this guy's material from his fucking comic tapes, and then we played it at his comedy store for his wake. You know, so we got to watch him do 40 minutes of totally disjointed, you know, like, you know, 8mm high 8, you know, digital 8, you know, HD standard def video of him.
Well, I've always wanted something in the world that does that, that sort of dual offer of capturing what we all get to, the comedians get to experience, which is the community behind it and all the crazy fragments and all the characters and all the stories and the clips and things that never really make it to stage. And then capturing the top 10% of what makes it to stage.
Yeah.
You don't have to wade through that 35 minutes of whatever to get to that they close with.
Yeah.
If you could mix those where let the audience understands, like, I mean, like the wake for Brody Stevens.
Yeah.
You know, and all the people getting up and talking about him and doing comedy about it. And nobody knows Brody Stevens.
Yeah.
Everybody in the community is like, oh my God, this guy's so unique.
Yeah.
And nobody gets the access to that.
Yeah.
You know, so those dual offers, I think, is interesting. You know, this Laugh Lounge and what I've always been interested in it. And I think you understand all that because you've been in the community for so long.
And I think those are great points. And it's like, this is a warehouse for history and comedy and for discovery, I think.
Because they kill it when it goes into the media, like, is it CNN this week or HBO or one of them is having the history of talk shows, and they're back to talking about Carson and all this, you know, Letterman and Leno and all this stuff. And I'm like, you don't understand what went on in talk shows. Like, this is not capturing the actual ethnographic community that makes talk shows work. Like,
you need to
talk to the crazy assholes in the writer's room and really understand this stuff, but they never do in the big media. They never really capture the core of it.
But that should be your show, Dan, writer's room. And you just show all that shit, you know?
I pitched that for a little while. And right before I left Hollywood full time was because all the great comedy occurs in the writer's room and it never gets to air because it's way too horrific and, you know, anti.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, next. I was back before COVID, I would go see Bill Maher taping all the time with Oshak and Danny Vermont. And you just see them, like, literally it's fucking right before air and they're like, all right, guys, let's get new rules started, you know, or whatever, you know, or let's get the, you know, for the pre and post show. But it's like, dude, it's like, they're playing the music. And I'm like, quick, guys, come on. Let's go. It's new rules.
Yeah, but that's because they've done all the work already. They're just cobbling it together.
Yes. Yeah. But I mean, for me, I was like, oh, shit, dude, my homework's due. Like, what the hell, you know?
It's super fun to when you get in that kind of engine.
Yeah.
Where you have those kind of pros working on things and they're just giving you, you know, 90% again that you don't use, but there's so much material and it's so good that you could make 10 shows each week.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't all be at A level, but I mean, these guys crank stuff. I mean, that's what I always really enjoyed about writing on staffs.
Well, and that's the talent really, right? It's like, you know, I think it's perfect transition for stand-up to writers and that stuff, because you're always trying to, you know, to come up with it. But yeah, what a lucky job, dude, by the way. Like, I was thinking about that. I watch Bill Maher all the time and I know how many writers they have. And it's just like, you know, they're spoiled, dude. You're just like, dude, like, you know, he's doing his monologue. He's like, yeah, that one, this one, we'll do that. Yeah.
And it's great. Once a week. So how hard is it? You know,
yeah, exactly.
Put that out. Exactly. So where do you go from here, Claude? You've done entrepreneur. You've tried to get these different companies up to breathing. Where, tell us where you're going next.
So, great question. two things that I'm, you know, according to my wife, I'm not doing shit right now. This is what I'm doing. I'm taking it easy. So I'm working on this process I don't know if I sent you this. It's called Pixie, but it's basically when you do it's a plugin for video editing that makes multi-camera editing super fast.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you were talking about that. So that's a tech project, right? That's something you discovered as a need within that job niche.
Well, yeah, I don't even know what to call it. It's just a big gap in between when you make a video for the night of show, like that you make together with everybody that you're like, you know, camera one, camera two, you know, cut that. Like that whole thing is never connected to the camera files or the source files. So we figured out a way to snap them together immediately. So if you're doing something and you got to turn it around in an hour, you can do that. You don't have to be like, okay, well, let me just get the fucking six camera angles and they're transferring it to the computer. And like, you know, and you still have to do that part. You have to get it in there. But with ours, you just import the line cut and click go. And it tells you what cameras go where. So working on that. And that's a whole other, you know, I got my ass kicked, you know, doing all the corporate documents for Laugh Lounge by missing corporate fee dates and shit like that. So now I know I'm a little more up to speed on Delaware corporations. So we did that, doing that one. And then I'm working on this other one that was called Dance Party, but the names are, that name is no longer available, even though we own Dance Party Inc. The Dance Party USA still has the trademark, so we may end up being into a different name, but it's an app that lets you create and share music videos with your friends that onto the same audio track. So it's kind of what TikTok is doing, but it's a little more kind of for adults, you know, it's like, it's like easy for an adult to use. So, but anyway, so working on those things and, you know, just trying to be a dad, you know. My daughter just got diagnosed with ADHD. So I was like, welcome to the family, you know. So I'm sharing her medication. And that's pretty much, I mean, that's it, man. I mean, what I really want to do is stop working so goddamn much because it's like my daughter's 8, you know, and I'm like trying to hang out with her as much as I can. And just, you know, and still flesh out these ideas. But I realize now, like, there's a great reason to take the talent scout role and just like pick the people out and be like, dude, I don't want to CEO all these companies. I don't want to run all these companies. I want to build them. But that's the other thing, dude, is that learning the corporate structure and navigating like venture capitalists and like doing all that shit is like, dude, I'm a fucking stand-up, dude. Like, you know, you wanted me to tell you like how to define a 10% convertible note with a 20% discount and a $3 million cap? Like, what the fuck are you talking about, you know? But you have to go learn that, you know? And it's
well,
like...
Well, it's interesting because I've worked in business here in Austin for the last 5 to 7 years and a lot of startups, a lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of tech people. And I've learned to see the difference in like people who kind of have their chops.
Yeah.
People are just dancing really fast in front of you.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And I was that guy too. I was, you know, I've been that dancing guy.
Well, and there's a time and place for it. Like you said, when you're learning and when you're trying to get something on its feet, you don't have any help, you don't really have money, then you got to dance. You got to have a good dance. And dude, that can do a lot for you. But then today, like you said, when you're filing for your Delaware and all, you have to have your act together. Like,
yes.
You can't just dance around for the court.
Yeah, you can't. Like, you know, there's reasons that there's corporate law and all that shit. And then, like, the other thing is that, you know, each lesson, to take it to heart and go back. Don't, like, fucking take your ball and go home. Like, dude, I had my ass handed to me before Laugh Lounge was even a thing. It was still, like, on a napkin. I took it to JFL, right? So I was like, oh, Just for Laughs, it'd be perfect. They loved this. Well, they did love it, but I didn't have my financial model buttoned up, like, fucking at all. And I was like, dude, idea, streaming service. Everybody likes it, you know? And so it's like, they, you know, they want to see your projections, you know? And they want to see, like, you know, they got that I could produce and direct and create content. I was like, I'm going to do a tech platform for stand-up. And they're like, sure you are, you know? And then I sent them I sat down and pitched them. Dude, I'll never forget this. In the bottom of the Roosevelt, and I had my CTO with me. And I went and pitched the financial model. And, like, dude, Bruce Hills, like, handed me my ass in front of everybody. He was like, hey, this is, you're crazy. These numbers are bullshit. Like, you know, and I was like, okay, I'll get back to you. You know, and it was like, but he handed me my ass and I took it. I took my beating because he was right. Right. And I, you know, I was stupid to present somebody else's model that I didn't understand fully in front of a group of people that were going to ask the hard questions. And it was the reason my partner decided not, he didn't want to go because he didn't want to be that guy.
Right.
So I was like, well, just fucking give it to me and I'll do it, you know? And Marine Corps shit getting me into trouble again. Anyway, so he...
Well, I bet, like, you, you just wrote the title of your biography or your headstone. Just give it to me, I'll do it.
Exactly.
That's your orientation. I've seen you do that with so many things. And dude, you work harder, and you know, like the ADD is one thing, but you've got energy to fucking bring to things at least. You don't just talk about them. You get in there and you'll actually move the gears and do the work. So that's always admired that about you.
Well, thanks, man. That time it ended up with I never had pit stains on the outside of my suit jacket, but I did that time. I remember leaving fuck, dude. But then I went back, revised it, and then I presented it and they bought it. The idea, they didn't give us any cash, but they were like, this is amazing. We'll give you content licensing deal. So there you go. So it was I got my ass kicked. I went back to the same people, owned it, you know, and admitted that I was a drug addict. I'm kidding. But I admitted that I was I was at fault. I didn't, I shouldn't have done that.
Yeah. I'm Claude and I'm a serial entrepreneur.
And I was
Claude.
Yeah. They were like, this motherfucker is back here. They're like, we must get him to go away. Give him a deal. So anyway, so then, now it's just, the kind of the silver lining is the bruises and the beatings that you take just equip you to go that much farther down the road. But it's kind of like you can't avoid them. You have to just be willing to take the beating. And if you don't want to take the beating, then be good at doing homework, before you get there. But otherwise, you got to follow some trajectory, or because if you plot your own, it's like you'll lose your ass.
Especially the worlds that you've chosen to work in. Hollywood will whip your ass. Yeah. Entrepreneurism will whip your ass. Tech, is competitive and will whip your ass. So you're getting whipped by three different masters. So
you guys got to leave a little something for my wife. That was my Felipe Esparza impression.
That's great. Well, cool, man. Super fun. I knew it would be. Always fun to hear what Claude's doing and all the energy in it. Pitch your stuff. Tell people where they can find Laugh Lounge, yada, yada.
Yeah, well, check us out, laughlounge.com. I'm huge on LinkedIn. No, I'm kidding. Laughlounge.com. You can download the Laugh Lounge app in the Google Play Store, the Apple, the App Store, I guess, for mobile. And come join the party. We're ever evolving, and we're really looking forward to just, filling the calendar with live shows this year. And it's I get to do my dream job. I get to hang out with all my comedy friends and then bring the world great comedy. And then, it's like a win-win. So.
Yeah. And you solve this and you'll be a hero with the comedians too. So there you go. You're loved worldwide.
Exactly. Finally.
Cool. Well, thanks, man. I appreciate it. This has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Come back and see us soon. Get out there, persuade some people. They need it.